If you're enjoying this podcast, please leave us a review and tap the follow button so that you never miss an episode.
All right. Hey, everybody. Welcome back to another Monday. And this Monday is Halloween. Happy Halloween. That's why we're all wearing costumes. And it's time for the extra spooky Halloween special episode of RFRX. Helen, yay! How are you this evening?
I'm awesome. It's my favorite holiday. Yes. I'm wearing my costume. I'm so happy. I'm
super happy for you there. Let me go ahead and just remove someone. Thank you. Yeah. Okay. There we go. Excellent. Yes. This is also my favorite holiday and I love dressing up and going to work in costumes or sitting at home.
I wish I could go to work in costume.
No, I'm pretty sure they're not going to allow costumes again after this year. I was running up and down the stairs in my spider outfit all day. It was pretty fun, which y'all can't really see, but I have spider legs on my outfit.
It is pretty cool that you have the spider legs. I do have a tail, but I'm not showing that off. Sorry.
Yeah.
Y'all have to imagine. You're just gonna have to imagine the tail, y'all.
Yeah. For those of you that are listening and not watching, Helen is a cat and I am a spider.
Yeah.
Anyway, moving on. I hope all of y'all also have costumes this evening. I see a few.
Yeah, I do too.
In the videos.
I love festive people.
Yes, this is definitely a good holiday to celebrate, especially if you're recovering from religion, because it's not a religious holiday. So we can have fun with it and enjoy it. And I'm super excited about our topically relevant topic this evening too, which I cannot wait to introduce. Okay, so let's talk about what we're doing here. We are about to bring on our guest speaker this evening, who many of you will recognize. He is a returning speaker. He's been on, I don't know, is it 9 times? It might be 9 times. He'll correct me if I'm wrong. He's going to talk for about an hour, and then we'll have a Q&A session for about 20 minutes. And in order for us to do that, we need questions. So if during the presentation you think of a question that you would like to ask, type it in the chat. And it helps us out if you write the word question in all caps in front of your question. And then that tells us that it's one that we should collect and save up for the Q&A. So feel free to pop those in the chat at any time. And then we'll have some closing thoughts from Helen when we wrap up at the end. And then we will turn off the recording and move into our super popular hangout session where we can continue the conversation, continue asking questions, talking about this topic or whatever other topics come up. And, you know, y'all can have an opportunity to show off your super cool costumes at that time if you would like to as well. And I'm super excited to see what y'all came up with. Okay. And that is what we will do this evening. So what do you say we get started on that, Helen?
Sure. I'm down. We are. I mean, it is Monday.
It is Monday. That's what we're here for.
That's why
Let's
we're here.
Do it. Let's
okay.
Do it.
So I'm going to introduce our own very own daredevil, David Teachout. He is a mental health therapist and photographer focused on teaching how creativity intersects with mental flexibility and working through inevitable difficulties in life. David grew up as a Christian fundamentalist, attending a Bible college and receiving a bachelor's in theology and psychology. During his studies there, David deconverted and has been on a journey of more deeply appreciating the many nuances of humanity ever since. David has a master's in both forensic psychology and counseling psychology and is currently working on his doctorate in clinical psychology. David has been actively working within the field of psychology as a therapist, social worker, advocate, and subject matter expert for over 15 years. So, David, welcome. We know we always love it when you're here because you're the best. You can go ahead and unmute yourself, and then we can start talking about why we're here, man.
I mean, somebody's happy to see me, and that's good. That's good.
Not just because you're my friend.
Did I get it right? Is this 9 times?
Yeah. I think this is number 9. Yeah. So we need to squeeze in like one more before the end of the year so I can go into next year with like a full on. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. With the winning
that'd
score.
That'd be good.
You're winning at RFRX.
You're winning.
Yep. Oh yeah. Yeah. So it's happy to be here. I'll do another shout out for the psychotherapy project. Not because I'm part of it, because it really is just a fantastic resource for people who are looking for licensed therapists in their state who are committed to not engaging their own religious proselytizing during, because unfortunately, despite the fact that it is against the ethics, that we're supposed to hold ourselves to, it happens all the time. In fact, one study, I believe is out of the UK, actually noted that 39% of the time people reported saying that their therapist engaged in a overt religious practice, despite even knowing that their client was not a believer. Wow. So it's pretty amazing. And unfortunately, it's not something that, again, it's not ethical, but trying to prove that is really tricky. So, You really want to delve into this, go in, get a doctorate. And this is actually what I'm working on in my dissertation for my doctoral program, is exactly this, kind of analyzing a non-religious experience in therapy and how to better, handle it. Because we really don't have, to be fair, psychologists really and therapists do not have, they're not taught any way of really dealing with this. So religion and spirituality are assumed to be a good. And so it's very tricky to step outside of that when that's really what you're taught throughout. So, and there are a fair number of even religious therapists that would be more than thrilled and are capable. It's not a de facto, like if you're religious, you're automatically going to be proselytizing. There's plenty that I know of that do great work. There's a lot of difficulties out there. So,
yeah, I am super excited to hear that you're doing research about that.
That is exciting.
It'll be really fun when I start doing interviews. So, will be sometime next year. So that'll be fun.
Cool.
So, we're looking for volunteers.
Yes, I bet I know where you can find some research participants.
I think so.
a few. Yeah. Not to freak anybody out, but hey, we're talking about
this. If only you worked at an organization that had people that were formerly a part of religion needing mental health care. If only.
It would be that. Yeah. Nope.
It's like you actually came up with a sensible dissertation topic.
Yeah, well, it has done to be one that you agree that you that you want and can have fun with, because otherwise the slog is the slog. So
yes.
I will be inordinately glad when I'm done. So let's just put it that way.
Yes. You will get there. Yeah. It's going to feel like you're not going to, but you will.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I just keep coming up with the presentations and we'll just kind of like keep going through. It'll be a milestone each and every time. Give up.
Exactly. If you do like 10 RFRX episodes, that counts as a dissertation, right?
Yeah. I'd love to pull that out. I'm pretty certain I could not pass that.
Present it to your professor. But, like, look, I did nice TED idea. Talks.
Yeah,
look.
Yeah. It could work. Yeah,
well, yeah. We certainly benefit from them.
Yeah. Well, thank you. That really, Rob. Topic as far as with tonight, I love everybody's costumes and I'm very much looking forward to seeing everybody's costumes at the hangout. If you feel comfortable, of course, obviously, later on, hanging out and showing, what costume you have. This is going to be fun. So I'm hoping that the not having a porch light means that people will not be knocking on my door very often, but we'll see. I don't have any candy. So yeah, I don't think they'll appreciate it if we give them like, you know, microgreens, broccoli and pea. So I don't think it's going to work real well.
No, don't get toilet paper. Just no.
No. So
the threat is real.
But, it is. And no candy. No candy, then it's cash.
Just give him pennies. Yeah. Like throw pennies in the bag.
Yeah, I'm an independent therapist. I do not have that kind of money to handle. So no, not how that works. So
yeah. But you're celebrating by talking to us about
fear. And you know what's so immediately people think of, most likely when you think of fear, is that like visceral response to something that is threatening. And while true, yes, spiders, snakes, darkness is a fundamental fear that the vast majority of people have to some degree. It's the fear of the unknown. Very interesting work on people who have never actually even encountered spiders and snakes. But when they're described, like immediately have a fear response. Very interesting. There's also some else, and we'll get into it a little bit later, around that you can actually have a fear response without even possessing an amygdala. You literally do not even have to have that, what we refer to often as the like fear part of the brain, you don't really actually need to have it to experience it. And we'll go into why. So here in a bit.
Spiders experience fear?
You know, I'm not sure. It kind of depends on how you define it. Aversion.
Aversion, like averting.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, even multicellular just bacteria. I mean, they will, shift, in response to, I wouldn't call that fear. I would think it needs an actual, level of conscious awareness, but not quite. But
because okay. Aversion, all day today, every time I hear a loud noise, I've been like this.
The nice thing about starting with aversion, though, is that it is at the foundation of a lot of the rest of the fear that we will be talking about. So initially, it's like we can look through like our intuition, and it's often related to physiological danger. So one of the resources that'll be in the list later, but is The Gift of Fear by Gavin DeBecker. And his focus on what fear is not really what I'll be focusing a lot on. It's an excellent book, but the one that'll be a little bit more closer is actually The Science of Fear by Daniel Gardner. And the difference is Gardner focuses on the kind of mental apparatus of how we determine, danger and all the biases that we have to deal with that are just baseline biological and so on. Whereas DeBecker, where Gardner would say, we often are afraid of physical things that or physical possibilities that we likely are not going to ever encounter. DeBecker comes in with some amazing material when we actually should be afraid of things that might happen to us, like physiological danger, stalking, these kind of things. And he walks through a lot of the, how do we train our intuition? How do we pay better attention to what our bodies are picking up, often at an unconscious level? How do we bring that to a conscious awareness and get better at it, especially if you are in a profession or doing work that will encourage, or encourage is probably the wrong word, it's not victim blaming, that might put yourself into a position where you're likely more prone to encounter dangerous situations, or you're just pissing off a lot of people online and starting to get death threats, and you want to be, you know, careful. He's excellent. He trains a lot of people, a lot of bodyguards, and is often sought after by, you know, people who have to deal with a lot of that on how to set up their security details. He's absolutely amazing. But that's not quite level where we're going to be going to. Instead, what we're going to be looking at is the everything up to that, which is, you know, basically, despite the fact that, yes, we can deal with true, like, real snakes that are poisonous, although who spends the time when it's right there wondering if it is outside of a cobra? Like, I'm not sticking around to, you know, measure the, what was it? There's like one where the scales on the
red and
the,
yellow
stomachs,
kill a
like,
fellow.
Yeah.
Red and black else. Friend of Jack.
You know what it's like to journey out of a once cherished belief. Maybe you were devoutly religious, escaped a cult, or perhaps you simply navigated out of some very difficult days, and now you'd like to help someone else do the same. Recovering from Religion is a wonderful support organization for people who feel confused, troubled, and alone as they come to grips with the possibility that they no longer hold a religious belief, or that they risk losing everything if they're honest with themselves and others about their journeys. These people need our help, and Recovering from Religion needs yours. RFR is seeking volunteers. Perhaps you're formerly religious, or you have a specific skill set like speaking a foreign language. Maybe you're just a good listening ear. The RFR Volunteer Training Program will help you translate those abilities into critical assistance, encouragement, and support for the men, women, and youth who contact RFR every day from all over the world. You can relate. You can understand. And you can make their journeys easier. Join the team at Recovering from Religion and remind someone else that they are not alone and someone is here to help. To find out more, click the volunteer tab at recoveringfromreligion.org.
That's it.
Yeah. Like, I'm not asking it to turn around and for me to look that closely. Like, I'm just leaving. So,
yeah, I cannot tell you how many times people have said to me, oh, but Kara, don't worry, the spider's not poisonous. And I'm like, first of all, I think you mean venomous, but I don't care. That's not the point.
And we have, of course, a comment about how that's not entirely accurate. So I figure my go-to of just getting the hell out of there is exactly, it's going to save me every time. So I don't have to worry about whether or not I'm full of it or not. So.
Yeah. No, that's not the point. Yeah. That's the fear response is not, I think this one might be venomous. Usually.
Yes.
Let me stand here and investigate it and poke it with a stick and see what happens.
Right. Yeah. So instead, what we're looking at, especially here then, is, you know, is when we put an emotional weight on things that have perhaps little legitimacy of truly causing us harm in a point that is long lasting or debilitating and so on. And it doesn't even have to be real. I mean, we can have, for instance, anybody here in the audience right now can picture in their minds somebody that they have a negative relationship with, and immediately start bringing to mind, like they'll start having an elevated heart rate. Might have, you know, a little bit of perspiration if you're hooked up to a monitor, you know, really, you know, might pupil dilation, like you're getting ready to fight or, you know, flee. Or I actually have added a fourth, like turtle up, where you just kind of hunker in and wait, and hopefully the thing will, you know, pass. But we can imagine these things. They don't even have to be real. They don't have to be immediate. It's literally just the creation of our imaginative capacity. And so, which is where we get into things like, you know, religious threat, where we get into, you know, the entirety of, you know, damnation and suffering, eternal suffering. It's like when we really start detailing some of these things, like one, it makes like no sense. You know, it's like, I don't even understand what the idea behind eternality here would be. Like, there's a point at which the event that you're experiencing becomes just the norm. So, you know, really at that point, the suffering must be a constant, like, you know, up and down. So in theory, hell would have to be at least momentarily peaceful, if only to ensure that the next bout of torture is truly that anus. So, you know, there it is. That's just how we process things. But it's just, it doesn't make any sense otherwise. But it's also around how we process, information around us. So, for instance, you know, the contagion effect, you know, so there's, I will share, sorry, this was not actually part of the resource that I sent, but how emotions by design, like in this, what we're going to get into is fear is fundamentally about creating or identifying a, you know, social connection of some kind. And what ends up happening is that we're looking for cues from others. And like, for instance, imminent danger. And then these social cues let us know when we need to be on guard. So we're like, we're constantly evaluating, you know, if we start seeing people run, you know, for instance, you know, we're immediately going to start going, what the hell? I probably need to be, you know, running this way. In fact, it takes training to overcome that, to run towards danger. It's one reason why people who are, you know, in the helping communities like police, fire, EMTs and so on, like, it's not, these people are not just amazing because of what they do as a social good, mm-hmm. in theory, but they also are amazing because they have trained to a point where they are capable of overcoming, at least to a limited degree, what most of us just would automatically engage with. And that is not a small thing. it's really not. Soldier is much the same way. Like, so much of it's why we talk about basic training as a kind of tearing down of the person in order to build them back up in the image of what is needed in order to engage in the behavior that they need. Because literally we need to tear down our basic impulses to, one, run away from danger, and frankly, not to harm. You know, so, you know, it's not a basic impulse for us to just immediately on contact, you know, harm people. We want to engage to some degree. So, you know, there's a whole other presentation there. But
that can be number 10.
We have to overcome these.
That's the number 10 topic.
We can talk about it. Putting you on the schedule.
Follow up to fear, be violence. Yeah, that'd be fun. Nice. So if we're, and a lot of this gets us into trouble because if we, especially when we are incredibly online all the time, what ends up happening? Well, the more that we are around and seeing people respond in a fearful way to or identifying something that you should be afraid of, the more our brain is taking those cues to say, well, perhaps I should be, perhaps I need to be. And when you combine that, because again, the brain is not, it didn't evolve, did not, you know, in a digital environment, clearly. It evolved in an environment that just says, look, the immediacy of identifying what is important and what is a danger needs to be dealt with, which means that it's translating that into even a digital world that is largely meaningless. You know, we were joking around before, you know, we started there about, you know, being truly afraid of that rainbow fentanyl that is supposedly being given to 8-year-olds because I guess.
Because
really,
Satan.
I'm sure it's Satan. Yeah,
and drug dealers. Fentanyl, something equals Satan.
Yeah. Exactly. So, but again, contagion effect. Once we start experiencing fear, we start looking around at people that we are already following. And by the choice of following, we've already given to that person or group a kind of acquiescence to our rational capacity. We've unloaded a part of our need for evaluating evidence to this person, even if it might be small. And so every time we engage with social connections, I mean, and so this is one reason why it's so important to keep track of, you know, who we're spending time with, whether or not we're spending time with people, all of which agree with us, and whether or not we ever find ourselves being challenged. Because every time we engage with somebody, we are essentially giving them some capacity for influencing our behavior. It's just how we're built. We are inherently social creatures. So this is the true danger of echo chambers. It's not hearing our own opinions back and forth. It's offloading our capacity to question at all. Now we need to, like, there's a point at which we can't, you know enough in order to understand exactly what we need to be in order to keep this one in topic, what we need to be truly afraid of. So we offload that, you know, to it, any more than, you know, we don't necessarily have to memorize phone numbers anymore. We've offloaded it to our phones. We don't need to, you know, memorize birthdays anymore very much. We've offloaded it to, you know, the internet. Like, we've given up. And I'm not being anti-tech here. I'm just saying this is just what we've done. But we've offloaded a lot of our engagement to things that, and to others that often we're not even fully aware of. You know, we get caught up in this lie, this self-deception that, well, I chose this. And of course, any thought that comes across my mind must in fact be mine and can't be at all influenced by anybody else. No, fundamentally not true. And the more we weight something, i.e. like when we're around the politics season that we're in, total shout out, by the way, next week, show up for next week's presentation on politics and why civic duty is still very important. It's going to be fantastic.
Please do.
Jason's amazing. Yeah. And it's going to be great.
Also vote, people. Vote. Sorry, we're going to talk. I'm going to push that in.
We're going to mention
the politics stock because we have 1 week, man.
Yes. Yeah. Do your civics. Yeah. So, and as well, you know, it's like we have here as well, you know, the immediacy bias, for instance. Anything that we feel right up front is given greater weight than what was before. It's one reason why, say, for instance, vacations. And so this is actually a bit of a trick. It's a sales trick as well. So if a person has a bad experience at the beginning, but has a good experience, positive one at the end of a particular event, they will judge the entirety of the event based on what happened at the end, because it's the most immediate, even if the negative actually, in a more objective fashion, may have resulted in greater loss overall. It's really, we do this all the time. It's why, it's why one of those things like, you know, if you want to save your relationship, go have a carefully controlled positive experience. Now, I'm not saying it's actually going to save your relationship, but it might buy you a little bit of time to build up other things, because what you've now done is allowed yourself to go, this just that last weekend, we had a great time. It was awesome.
Well,
and so this really can't be that bad.
It sounds like it's like a version of the sunk cost fallacy. Like you're investing all this stuff in like your relationship and things have been really shitty, but we had a really great weekend and everything was perfect. But like 98% of the time you're fighting and you're not being intimate and you're not engaging, but you had 1 week and it's like, maybe we'll be okay. Maybe we'll work it out.
Oh yeah. All the time. And this also plays the role, speaking of, for instance, fear or depression, anxiety, you know, it's this, we'll often hear, ourselves saying, well, wait a minute. I've been feeling this like all the time. And you're going, no, really, you're not. One, because it's physiologically incapable of actually doing that. But two, it's, this is why journaling can be a positive and very helpful practice, because it allows us to more concretely take a look at what our experiences are, so that we can take a look and go, you know what, I'm thinking right now because I just was depressed, for instance, or fearful that I've been afraid or depressed, oh my God, for weeks. And you go, you know, I heard this presentation from RFR. Maybe I should go take a look at my journal and, consider the fact that, wait a minute, last week or even 2 days ago, for instance, I had recorded the fact that I had a good moment. You're like, oh, I had a good day. Today was actually pretty positive or just benign, in fact. And so anytime we can engage in a more concretizing of our experiences, the better. I'm getting ahead of myself a bit. That's part of at the very end about solutions here. But just as a point of reference, like that can be, super helpful on that. And in fact, it goes into a bit. I love everybody who filled out the initial poll. I do want to know the person who's practicing to be Daredevil though. Because if Charlie Cox is actually here, I will totally fanboy the hell out of it. So yeah, that'd be amazing.
Should we share the poll results? Do you want to go over them?
Oh yeah. Wait, let's
okay. Let me see if I can do that. 1 second. Okay, I am going to share the results and I'll read them off for people who are listening. Question one, is fear a tool only of the powerful? 19% said, of course, it's a way to control us. 75% said, no, because I won't fall for that only stuff. You've got these people trained.
I do, yeah.
Big brain.
People know my questions.
Yeah, they're ready for it. And 3% each said, clearly, because I'm only afraid of things more powerful than me, or fear, what fear? And then question two, if I could remove fear from my life, would I? 31% said yes, 25% said no, 41% said that sounds dangerous, and 3% are practicing to be Daredevil. So yeah, we do need to follow up on that. We'll be asking about this in the hangout. Question three, is fear a rational response? 9% said no, it's an emotion. 47% said yes, it's an assessment. 3% said no, you're confusing categories. And 41% are smelling a trap. They're on to your tricks. Okay, and then turns out everyone's excited to see Charlie Cox return as Daredevil. We did not give them an option to not be.
No. Yes, this is welcome to a Fox News poll where the answer I get want is already embedded in the answers.
We're in the Cox cult now.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. That's, I love it. And what's interesting there, and we'll get into why getting rid of fear entirely, any more than getting rid of any emotion, is, well, one, impossible outside of severe brain damage, and in fact is truly, really dangerous, but is not actually anything that we want, truly. If we were to really think through, like, fear is as an assessment of in a way of connecting to things that matter. So fundamentally, fear is in some ways, kind of related to anger in this way, in the sense of we don't get angry about things we don't care about. Like literally, we really don't even think about things that we don't really care about. It just doesn't enter our conscious awareness. The difficulty is that everything that does enter our minds in a conscious level is important, but it's not equally important. So it's one of the things that I work with clients around is acknowledging how every thought and emotion that comes up without our choice I mean, literally, I have to just pause for a moment and just kind of go, what's your next thought? You didn't choose it. It just appeared. Nobody, you know, you didn't pause and go, I think I'm going to have out of the next 10 possibilities, this thought. You know, there it is. I mean, literally the practice itself is its own thinking. You're already like, that's what it is. So, and so part of what's going on is recognizing, okay, well, since these things are already happening, the question isn't whether or not they're true in a generic sense. It's how much weight do I want to give to them? Just because I have an emotional experience, just because I have a thought, does not mean that I must weight it in the same degree based on or regardless of the context that I'm in. You know, we're going to have, you know, a lot of ways to, you know, fear even of itself or anger, the way that we talk about it is going to be contingent upon the context in which we're in. So the interesting conversation going on, we'd love to, we'll address some of those comments there in the chat here in a bit. So, excellent. You know, what we're having here then is this fear response in relationship to the connections that we have to what we care about and the people in our lives, both immediate and imagined. Oh, there's a kitty. Oh,
she wanted attention. Okay. Sorry. Everybody say hi to Bellatrix.
She's so cute.
Hi, Bellatrix.
Okay, sorry, kitty time.
So,
go ahead.
In response to, yes, a comment that was made around, you know, fear is an emotion. Yes, absolutely. But what is an emotion? What? How do these things, you know, work in our lives? And there are a couple of different ways of looking at it. So one, an emotion is a physiological response. You know, it's triggered by some aspect of our experience. What that is supporting or undermining, and here's the trick, how we believe the world is or should be. So fear here is the response to having that experience in which it's telling us, oh, wait, something is happening that does not fit the way you think the world is in order to serve the things that matter or should be in order to serve the things that you believe exist. So it's effectively, I think the world is going to act, you know, in this way, A through D. Something happens that throws that off. And now we have a fear response. And here's the trick behind, and here's the subtle thing here, because what's happening here is the loss of how we see the world. It's the loss of being right. It's the loss of, oh, now I understand how the world works. In fact, we don't, hence fear, because now everything is caught up in uncertainty. And so, you know, and this is where, you know, there was a comment earlier, it was very Deepak Chopra, that was around, fear cripples the brain. You know, we can get rid of it if we're, you know, if we're just completely filled with true love. By the way, anytime somebody adds true as a like a adjective, as a descriptor, and then onto a particularly feeling or an identity, really good clue that they're one, not interested in actually having a real conversation, but two, that they're about to catch you into a no true Scotsman fallacy. So it's really, yeah, yeah, this is true, which really means believe me or else. Yeah. My way of viewing this is accurate. Anything else is false. Well, convenient.
Anyway. It's probably a case of redefining some terms too.
Like,
well, we all do it, but it's redefining it to the exclusion of any other possibility. I mean, I have no problem with the evolution of language. I mean, it's, but it's any time we're like, no, this is the only way now. It's really not that helpful. Yeah. Anybody who totally wants to nerd out about that, the Great Courses has a fabulous course on Language A to Z by John McWhorter. And literally he goes A through Z as far as like here are words that have meant various things throughout the past, throughout history, and how we can, you know, evaluate, you know, some of the changing paradigms of how we think about language. Utterly hilarious if you like nerdy humor. And it's also really, really informative. So
yes, we
shout out to nerds. Yes.
We're all nerds here.
That's what we're here for.
That's right.
We're learning about fear on a Zoom call on Halloween. Let that sink in for a minute.
We are doing that. Yeah. So and to kind of wrap up that one point, like, you know, the difficulty here is like, well, you know, even if we would get rid of the word true, like love, peace, joy, creativity, like all of these things actually already exist in order for fear to be present, because we'd only fear of the loss of the things that matter to us. So why are we afraid of, you know, totalitarian regimes? Because of a loss of freedom and creativity and, you know, the capacity to love, you know, people in a consenting relationship. Like, this is what we are, you know, concerned over. So, you know, one way then of, you know, kind of connecting, okay, well, so we have emotions as a way of connecting to what matters to us. We also have a way of connecting between us and those around us. And, you know, from Lisa Feldman Barrett's book, How Emotions Are Made, you know, it's like we find that, you know, emotions are not built in, but made from more basic parts. They're not universal, but vary from culture to culture, i.e. the context that determines what matters and how does it matter? How do we think that the world is or should be is largely derived from the various cultures that we're in. And they're not triggered in that sense. You create them. You know, they're emergence, you know, combination of physical properties, you know, our own internal mechanisms, why we can have the concept of being hangry, because we're effectively being really hungry because we forgot to eat or we're out of fast, and things that used to not really matter to us, suddenly it's like, oh my God, this is huge. Why? Because again, we've increased uncertainty by not having, a regular caloric intake. And so the body's going, the future's uncertain. Now what? Well, now I'm afraid or uncertain, kind of like fear light. And now I'm going to, you know, go scrambling to get something to, you know, deal with that uncertainty, to address it. So, you know, we have not only what's going on internally, but we also have a flexible brain, thankfully, you know, that wires itself to whatever environment, you know, it develops in, you know, in a culture and upbringing, which provide that environment as well. So, you know, in many ways, you know, looking at emotions, we can see them as in a kind of collective, let's just say it, a collective hallucination based on a shared physiological response and a need for life to make sense. And we gauge how well life is making sense, that it is consistent, that if I do A, B is going to result, by looking around at the people in our lives and going, if I say A, if I say this thing and signal that essentially, like, wait a minute, I really want to make sure that I'm still, you know, good with people, or the way that I think about what thing is happening. So I will spout my opinion on social media and get inundated by people going, yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah, that's right. That other people is awful.
Or okay. Everyone fear says, abated. Well said.
Yes.
Fear is abated. We're now okay. Very, very helpful with that. And so this gets us, you know, a bit into then about, well, wait a minute, how do we assess fear? Like, why, how do we go about then determining, you know, well, if so much of this is about how we relate to one another, how does that actually work? What are the mechanisms that we're kind of checking in with one another to determine whether or not my way of viewing the world is accurate, and that my place in it is where I think it is. Mm-hmm. And by place, I'm referring to status. And this is where we get into fear as a way of an imagined slight, as an imagined loss of something that we, you know, thought we had and now, you know, now don't. And so, you know, from this, you know, looking at the status game by Will Storr, highly, highly recommend, though, gotta say, I need to send an astigram to him because he's totally reading his book, has heightened my anxiety recently because he's kind of looking around and going, game again. And, you know, seeing so much of it, how it engages our behavior. So, but he notes how much of the rest of human life is largely comprised of three varieties of status striving and three varieties of game. So one, dominance. Fear definitely has a role to play in that. Virtue, which itself can be then, you know, connected to the loss of, hence uncertainty and fear. And success as well, which itself as well is then related to a loss or potential loss. In virtue games, status is awarded to players who are conspicuously dutiful, obedient, moralistic. Hence the fear that if you are no longer at this level that you might be, you know, brought down. You know, Herschel Walker, anybody? You know, in dominance games, you know, status is coerced by force or fear. And usually that is because, you know, a person will engage in that kind of manipulation precisely because the virtue and success game, they are thought to believe that it is, what's the big political word these days? Rigged.
Yeah.
Because if you think that these games are inherently incapable of being won or capable of moving socially within, you know, success and virtue, if it's all against you, what are we going to do? Well, we're not going to abdicate from playing at all. We literally are incapable of it because we're apes. Instead, we're going to go, well, shoot, let's just get right into, you know, fear and force. So let's burn it all down. Let's give ourselves over to the person who says, yeah, that's right. It is rigged. That's why you can't move in the way that you think it is. And here we are.
Ooh, this sounds somebody like mentions it has January 6th. Yeah, definitely some current consequences. People stop thinking you can play the game by the rules, then we have new strategies popping up.
Yep. Well, and it's rules that, you know, are at least perceived as being constantly changing. Mm. And it's not helped by the fact that we actually can, you know, see where, you know, things are, in fact, as recent comment, like rigged to a degree. Mm-hmm. So, you know, things are, you know, it is easy to see how power accrues to at a top to a degree where it is, thank you for the caveat to the comment, or, you know, it's to a degree where it's like, and so once we start seeing it, now what happens? Well, now we get into confirmation bias. We get into back to immediacy effect, because what do we want? Once we have determined that this is how the world acts, then we will seek to see that consistency, because in order to reduce uncertainty, we're going to make the world make sense, even if we have to ignore all the nuance.
Now,
because we don't want to feel fear.
Does this also have to do with, you know, how people get into like conspiracy theories and things too? Is it part of like, okay, I am going to come up with a simple answer that explains something about the world that I will just hold to? Wow.
The added benefit to conspiracy theory there is that it's actually another way of playing, you know, a status game. it's another way of saying, because say for instance, you know, I can't succeed, or I perceive myself as not being able to succeed in, you know, this broader circle, social circle, with my opinions. Well, if I narrow myself down to a smaller circle, suddenly, even though I'm still a small fish, at least I'm in a smaller pond. And therefore, I will have a greater outsized influence and way of moving, you know, moving up the hierarchy of what's here. And so what happens? You go on to some social group online or whatnot, or subreddit, where what are you getting? You're getting likes, thumbs ups, up tags. I think does Reddit still do that, where it's like you're voting up and down?
Yeah.
It's been a long time. Reddit's very bad for me. I will totally get lost in it. But we're looking for these things in order to see that every time we see that, it's that shot of learning that is occurring between here's my opinion and its connection to the world. And every time I see an affirmation, it further solidifies and allows me to reduce that fear and that uncertainty.
It seems also too that, you know, having, if you feel like you have special knowledge, especially with the conspiracy theories, and the world is very chaotic and random, and it gives certain people this feeling like, well, I have this special knowledge and now I have more control over the fear I have that, you know, something's going to be taken away from me, or, you know, there's satanic pedophiles in the White House or whatever it is, you know, like if I have that knowledge, then maybe there's something I can do about it, or at least I feel a little bit safer that I have this special knowledge that, you know, and then this, my people in my group also have this knowledge and maybe we can do something about it, you know?
Yep. Absolutely. Yeah. Well, and there's, I mean, if essentially special, any kind of revelation, any type of thing that is unique to you, particularly if you can tie it to a particular identity. So, you know, it's really, how many of us have encountered parents that are like, you know, in the opposite way, where it's like, I really thought that once I was a parent, like, I just know what to do.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's not being stupid by any means. It's literally like a hope. Like, doesn't this just, you know, doesn't the knowledge just occur as soon as, you know, the kid's born? It's like, no, not really. But it's an easy way of thinking, because, well, wait a minute, we look around and go, well, these identity, this group of people called parents, seem to know what's going on, especially the ones that I'm seeing, for instance. Therefore, if I am now belonging to that category, it should come along, right? It's tied to the category, right? Not about experience, and certainly not about questions, and certainly not about, you know, challenging. Oh no, it has to be tied to the ideological or identity category. Like, nope, here it is. It's an automatic thing, you know. And we do it all the time. I mean, it's and this is it's another actual way of looking at contagion as well. Is that why do we pay attention to celebrities? Well, because if they are popular and powerful in one arena, well, must they not then therefore be powerful and right and accurate in this other arena? I mean, that's why, you know, the over and over and over again, you know, the what is looked at as, you know, kind of socially conceived of as attraction, you know, people who embody that kind of normative, you know, way of looking at it, or of looking or of seeing or being, or of appearing rather, used my right word. You know, they are given an automatic, you know, added bonus to, well, you must be right. Because if you hold this quality, well, must it not be, you know, the rest here? You know, why do celebrities, you know, run for public office? We're coming back to Walker again. It's like, well, you know, and in fact, the people listen to how they actually are presenting themselves. It's often, I accomplished this, therefore I must be good over here. Even though, and those who caught the question before, like, wait a minute, this is a category error. This is what's going on. Like, wait a minute, this is a category error. This is not necessarily good. You know, what was, you know, for that matter, what was Trump's fundamental thing? You know, it's like nobody thought about whether or not his business has actually ever succeeded. They literally, you know, it's an easy association between, well, his name is on, you know, gold lettering. It's an easy way of recalling the name itself. Therefore, it must hold weight in other categories as well. It's just how our, you know, brains work. And because we're wanting that consistency, we're wanting that ease. Why? In order to reduce uncertainty and therefore fear.
I see how this is tying into a whole lot of like cognitive biases and logical fallacies.
Mm-hmm. Some wow. Dunning-Kruger. Yeah. Like there's a lot of, it's very interesting, you know, and it's interesting too, because like when you start, when you pull yourself back about it and you're thinking it through the lens of like a fear response and how we react to things and that we react to, we're fearful without, sometimes we don't even know that we are, we're just reacting, you know, it's, mm-hmm. it's very interesting in the wider spectrum of like, we live in a society of that, you know, of yep. How much it affects us without us really even thinking about it.
Yeah, no, absolutely. In fact, I want to address, you know, this question that posed around, because I was actually going to bring this up. So thanks for cueing that. You know, about why some people seek out fear-filled or anxious responses, like, well, we're in Halloween, haunted houses, scary movies, you know, I guess according to the internet, let's not talk about the latest Halloween movie, I guess, who knows. But, you know, why do we go after these, you know, these movies? They just like the fright fests of what we're dealing with. So here's the thing. Tie everything we've been, you know, talking about here. If an emotion is tied to something we care about, and fear is tied to a projection of loss, then any time we deliberately engage in it, what we're doing is reminding ourselves of what's important to us. And by doing so within a controlled environment that we choose, we're effectively actively doing so in a way that goes, now I get to have this immediacy effect, this powerful response that lets us know, I love life. I love, you know, why are slasher flicks going after families, going after loved ones, going after, you know, people that matter? Because that's exactly what fear is about. It's about the things that matter. And so every time we engage with that kind of experience, it's a kind of, hyper arousal to, you know, pointing us in the direction of, wow, isn't it amazing that I'm sitting here alive? You know, it's similar to the effect of why people were so, and still are, drawn to shows like, the daytime shows where people embarrass themselves on TV.
I don't know what those are called, but the ones where you find out, you know, it's the eighth time.
Yeah, it's actually he's not the daddy, he is. And you're like, why are people doing this? And why are people watching it? Yeah, Maury Povich. Or used to be. Is he still even doing a show?
I don't know.
But really what we're doing is having this heightened response in this form, judgment, in order to then draw our attention to, I am not nearly that messed up. Don't I feel better about myself? And what I feel better about are the things that matter to me. That's why, you know, they stick with these, you know, themes in these shows, because they're universal. It's great to be able to, you know, take a look at. So
okay. So if you watch a scary movie with a significant other or a date or something, will it make you feel like you value them more or feel closer? Like, is this a life hack we can take with us?
I mean, what's the old, I actually don't know the research on this. I'm not even certain that there is deliberate research on it, but I mean, what's the often hope? You have a scary movie and all of a sudden it's like, oh, come here. We're drawing closer. And then, I mean, this is, yeah. But yeah, first date, let's watch this slasher film. Why?
Because it's not creepy at all.
It gets people focused on life and what is more important than the expression of life than, well, you know, sexual energy. Well, I mean, an expression. So, yeah.
I mean, like me and my husband, during this month, we cuddle and watch scary movies together. So, you know, it's our thing. We love it. We love horror movies and being scared together and stuff. Well, yeah. I get scared and then he laughs at me because he has a higher tolerance for stuff than I do. But that's what we do, you know. We've been doing it all the years we've been together. So,
and
sometimes we have sex after we watch a scary movie, so
life hack, that's
how you get laid, people. Watch a scary movie with your significant other.
Yep. Well, in fact, what was the Midnight Mass? Absolutely amazing.
So
show.
Good.
Yes.
Absolutely incredible.
My former Catholic in me was like, I had a lot of feelings.
Yeah. Just unimaginably good. It's incredible. Anyway, So, you know, so this is about tying us back to things that matter. So, in fact, And here's the trick then about why then do people, which goes back to that first polling question around, well, it's only used, you know, by people who are more powerful. It's a little more complicated. and it's about, why do we use fear for manipulation? And the reason for that is because it is tying us to the thing that matters. So, you know, it's like, because then we're thinking about, wait a minute, I might lose this, and we're losing sight of what's happening right in front of us. Mm-hmm. You know, why is politics so huge on causing fear around, you know, whatever their pet thing is, as a party or as an individual? It's in order to get you into a position of not paying attention to what's in front of you, but associating that person with being able to solve and protect the thing that they are getting you to believe might be, you know, at a possibility of loss. It's a great tactic, works really well. It's why they keep doing it. Yeah,
you're right. It's always, you know, they're about to take away your fill in the blank with literally anything. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Which is why, you know, some of the latest polling around, like, wow, you know, the people that really care about right now is gas prices and inflation. No, they don't. what's really concerned about is the capacity for being able to affect their own lives. And gas prices and inflation are just one way of doing that. So how do you speak to it? You don't actually even deal with gas prices or inflation. You deal with the underlying value that the person feels like they're not going to be able to support. Mm-hmm. And so for instance, like in the last few minutes here, you would go into, well, then what are we going to do with all of this, you know, fear? What do we do about dealing with the fact that, one, fear is inevitable. We're never going to get rid of it. So what do we do? So one is evaluate your beliefs based on probability rather than whether or not they're true or false. Get out of the epistemic binary. Get out of the knowledge binary. Get into how, wait a minute, if I had to put a, say, real money on this, for instance, what would I be more likely to do? Put money on this belief or put money on, for instance, a you know, a 50-50 choice or a 25% choice. If I'm going to put money more on the 25% choice, then clearly I think this opinion I have less than that. So maybe I should probably back off a little bit from guiding my life by it.
Oh,
just as a way of looking at it. Yeah.
Okay.
And so probability.
Would you also recommend that for if you're trying to talk to someone about something they're afraid of too?
Yes.
Like help absolutely. Them think about it that way. Oh.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. Getting away from whether or not this is true or false. One, our brains don't really care anyway. It's not really interested in true and false. It's
I don't care if it's venomous.
Yeah, really, I mean, it's does this knowledge, you know, further my way of making the world close to what I think it should be? It's really a lot of what everything boils down to. And so that ties into when I'm afraid. So when we're afraid, connect to that thing that's important. You know, if we're afraid of, say, okay, wait a minute, I have this fear, oh, it's tied to loss of, you know, loved ones. How do we deal with that? Reach out to them. Engage with that value. Actively pursue how you're going to show up in support of it. It's not going to necessarily get rid of the fear so much as reshape the relationship you have with it to guide you to living the life you want to live anyway, i.e. serving that which matters to you. So instead of getting focused on the initial emotion, what is it pointing you to? Engage with that.
Okay.
You know, when afraid, do not make big decisions or judgments. You know, unless, of course, you're in immediate danger. That's when we get back to De Becker's work. Like, if you're, I mean, somebody's attacking you, you know, this is not the time to go, you know what, I really have to be concerned here about identifying what is important to me. So can you please hold off the knife attack? No. Like, you immediately react. But most of the time, we're not in that kind of immediate danger, thankfully. You know, don't make big, you know, judgments or large decisions when we're in the midst of that. Just not really helpful. If someone is stoking your fear, so now we get back to the politics thing. And sometimes, you know, politics of anything or religion for that matter. If someone is deliberately stoking your fear, identify what the value is that is most triggered to see what is being manipulated. Because it's not the fear. That's the thing that's the big flashy lights that's getting you. Like, we need to look behind the curtain and see what the wizard is. And that wizard is the thing that, you know, is important to you. So whenever we engage in, say, you know, this was huge and still is around, you know, COVID precautions. You know, at the end of the day, if a person is doing all of the things that, you know, we, you know, socially in a social environment, especially a constrained social environment, say, you know, medical center, and they are, you know, fully masked, if they are, you know, testing for temperature and so on, you're like, they have no symptoms. We've identified all this. They're also wearing a legit mask, not some silly cloth one. But a, you know, legit one that's being handed out there, like, okay, so do we really need to, you know, be afraid? Unless somebody comes up then and says, well, wait a minute, are they vaccinated? Oh, well, now what's going on is they're stoking the fear in order to think about the loss that you might have, not based on the person's actions, because nothing fundamentally changed in that moment. You fundamentally, whether a person is vaxxed or not, pro-vax, by the way, this is not about being, you know, that. It's about being very clear about what our fear is based on. So when, you know, if before we were fine, then the added piece of information that is stoking our fear is not about the assessment. It's about the fear. It's about the loss that we now are imagining ourselves to, you know, potentially experience.
Oh.
So even though in the moment, we actually don't have any extra, like, this didn't suddenly expand our potential for danger. because in this particular scenario, we have no way of judging one way or the other. If the person has no symptoms whatsoever, then whether or not they are or not, it's kind of, you know, useless. Well, it really doesn't add anything. It's actually answering a different question.
Oh, it's like your brain is just like finding something else to be afraid of.
Interesting.
Now, would this work also for things like that you got kind of taught to be afraid of? Like we talked a few weeks ago about like being afraid of being possessed by demons or going to hell or things like that. Does this thought process also help you talk yourself down from those kinds of things too?
Yep, absolutely. Because what is fear? You know, the fear of hell is essentially what, you know, in fact, what's interesting there is, the Bible in quotes there, you know, refers to, or some of the interpretation of it has now been like, well, hell is the loss of being in the presence of God, for instance. Well, what is that? One, it's a projected loss in the future, but two, it's the embodiment of things that are good, things that we want, a felt sense of meaning and purpose, felt sense that our actions are capable of affecting change. So, I mean, literally what fear, what hell is the kind of psychological embodiment of all of our projected fears and all of the loss that we might experience. And so what do? Well, in order to reduce that, here's the solution, this thing back here, even though what we're actually afraid of is not being dealt with by this. You know, salvation doesn't deal with any of that. what it actually is doing is getting us to create a world now in the hopes of we will address the things that we might lose. But if we pause and go, wait a minute, am I really under any actual concern of losing this? I mean, really? Well, if not, then why do I need your solution? Mm-hmm. Why do I need your authority to do this?
Mm-hmm. Interesting.
Always come back to what it is that you're concerned with losing.
Okay.
You know, take the emotion, thank it, you know, and say thank you for pointing me in the direction of what matters. this is what I'm going to draw my attention to. And this in fact gets us to the last thing, which is in conversation, when someone states their fear, one, never mock it. This is not about, you know, this is totally not helpful, but consider the value that they're directing attention to as justification. You know, listen to, I'm afraid of this because I'm going to lose my freedom. Or my, you know, some family member might be put in danger for this. Like, I need this to happen in order to address this. And then start focusing on that rather than the fear itself.
Oh, it's like the old focus on interests, not the position kind of advice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, pretty much. You're not going to move the position. They've already sunk in. And by they, I do mean we as well. this is not like, oh my God, we've figured things out and we've reached a new, you know, evolved state of humanity. We're all prone to this. So
yeah, I'm sad to learn that we are still susceptible.
We're all people doing people shit.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's pretty much what we're doing. So
pretty much. Yeah. What's in fact, there was one. Yeah. From Will Storr's book, humans are today as we've always been. Ambitious and delusional animals. things haven't changed. You know, Anil Seth in his book Being You, another one I highly recommend. You know, it's like we're all, you know, living a kind of a constrained hallucination and that is called consciousness. And our, but the thing is, our biology tricks us into thinking that it's all real. Like literally every single thought and emotion that happens to pop up must be taken seriously right now. Take a breath. No, it doesn't. It's okay. That's why we, you know, take some of these, you know, so-called solutions and, you know, get to, wait a minute, what is this about? It's not the thought itself. It's what it's pointing us to. And if once we identify that, then we can slow down to determine, okay, how am I going to show up and serve these things? How do I take care of and remind myself of how important family is, how important my freedom is, you know, how important being a person of integrity and honesty is? Because we're going to possibly lose those things, all the better that we exhibit them as much as possible now.
Mm. Wow. That's a really interesting way to frame that. I love that. I feel like I'm equipped now with actual tools to deal with actual situations. Man, this is helpful. I didn't realize this was the kind of advice we were going to get tonight, and I am super pumped about this.
I feel like I have a new tool until my ADHD brain kicks in, and then I'll forget that was a tool I was supposed to be using. So
right. Then you'll go back and listen to this on the podcast.
Yeah, I will, and I'll be like, that's right.
Be reminded. Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. Yeah. Okay, and we also have a ton of questions that we can get into, but do you have any more comments or advice for us, David, before we go to those?
Really kind of basically reiteration of that last point. Like, you know, we are, so one of the best things that we can do with ourselves, and I know it's going to be like, well, yeah, is to take ourselves off of social media for times. Like the entirety of, you know, that entire apparatus, every version of it is based on putting ourselves into zero-sum games where I need to get a like, I need to get a follow because, you know, it's a follow that somebody else may not get, and it reinforces how I see the world. And it goes to the baseline emotional, you know, assessments that don't make us reflective. It's not designed for. Nobody wants us to be reflective because we'd reflect ourselves right off of it. You know, a little play on words there. Anyway, it's just like we would, you know, so the idea here is to slow down and remind ourselves, wait a minute, what do I care about? And let's get busy taking care of those things that are real, concrete. It's one of the most basic pieces of, you know, advice and encouragement that I give all my clients is get out of here, your head, and into making things as concrete as possible with the people that matter to you. And that means yourself. The more you make these things real, the better we're all going to be. Flat out.
Yeah. Okay. Excellent advice. Wow. Okay. That is really good. I'm going to be pondering that for a while. Thank you for that. That's great. Okay. And also, okay, we have some questions, and I want to start with this one because someone is asking if they have got it correct. So let's start with this one. They said, I want to make sure I have this right. So let's say there's a fear of someone killing you. Is the idea to realize the fear is resulting from a fear of a loss of life, and then realize how much I actually like life and I'm afraid of losing it, which then opens up some space or empathy for that feeling, and then start using things like thinking logically about the probability. Is that correct? I realize that was a long...
Was that the last one? Yeah, I want to make sure I got this right.
Yeah. Okay. Yes.
Yeah. So do you realize fears? I love it. Nicely done. Yeah.
Awesome.
And that's completely legit. It's like, in fact, there's I really need to take this off because it's really, really itchy.
I guess we'll allow it.
Yes, I'm bald. And you know, the so it's actually one of the, it's a meditative practice where we can, where we actively engage with you know, the idea of us dying. And one of the consequences of doing so is a deep, deep appreciation for the life that we are actually living, because it is drawing our attention to what the fear is pointing us to, and that is the loss that we're afraid of having and experiencing.
Okay. That's great. That's such a good framing of that. I really like that. Wow. Okay. I'm processing. Helen, go with another question.
So you can process.
I'm processing. My little spider brain is processing.
Okay. So this kind of goes back to what a little bit of the politics discussion we're having. Are politically conservative people really more fearful than politically liberal people?
No.
Okay.
Yeah. There's some interesting, I mean, you'll see, you know, studies at times that one way or the other, and almost always, if you really dig into the details, they're not really controlling for other variables. This is about, you know, are people who identify with a particular political persuasion, depending on the time frame we're in, are going to be more afraid than others, you know. And if we go at the, if fear is about a sense of loss, then what are, you know, one, that's all you can really see now in political ads, but it's like, you're going to lose this, you're going to lose this, you're going to lose that. But it's, you know, those who are, in fact, this may include why, you know, the party pretty regularly that is in power loses seats in a non-presidential election year. Because the opposite party is more, is more, you know, aroused around the idea of, you know, the loss that they've been experiencing. They don't want to keep it anymore. They don't want to have it anymore. Mm-hmm. So they're going to, you know, they show up. It's at least one variable involved. But there really isn't any, you know, there isn't any legitimate thing. It's all about time frame and topic. You know, there are certainly ideology, political ideology or any, will induce a greater fear about certain things. Sure. But, you know, as a blanket statement, not really. Yeah.
Well, I would have to imagine too that, like, we're all human beings doing human being shit. And they have the same fears and worries that everybody else does. It's just ideologies in response. Is different.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the basic underpinnings of that, you know, fear of.
Okay. I think we might have lost Helen. Yeah.
I feel safe.
Oh, there she is.
There we are.
We lost you for just a second.
Oh, I was talking the whole friggin' time.
Yeah. That's how it usually goes.
That's fine. I made some good points, and I am so smart. Too bad you can't hear them now.
They're locked in,
you know, through the ethosphere. Yeah. Well, and this goes to part of, there was another question around, do religious people have different fears than not? You know, same kind of thing, like on the political spectrum, just religious. And so this is why I phrased earlier this very specifically, and I'll come back to it here. Is that one way of looking at fear or emotion in general is that it's a triggered by some aspect of our experience that is supporting or undermining how we believe the world is or should be. And how we think a thing is or should be is basically another way of saying worldview, ideology, narrative. That's really all we're talking about here, is all of these different ways of viewing things are just various ways of guiding our attention to how we then believe the world is or how we want it to be. And that's where it's going to, you know, tie into, you know, our emotional responses.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. Okay, that's a good segue into another question that somebody just put in the chat. What is the role of fear in things like prejudice?
Yeah. So imagine from it. So prejudice, really take a look at all the details every time it comes up. It's about the loss of either social influence. It's about the loss of economic help. It's a loss of, cultural power and influence. What's the latest thing around basically the anti-Semitic craziness coming out of Kanye? Besides the fact that the man is clearly suffering from serious mental health issues, but he's not the only one that spouts this kind of garbage. So, you know, listen to the details rather than just the fear itself and going, it's always about, I'm about to lose my finances. I'm concerned over the social influences that this group has over their ability to control and influence my capacity to make a living and therefore support family and have an influence on the world. It's really, prejudice is, you know, and all we're doing is, you know, is applying that. You know, prejudice is just a way of directing attention to a particular quality, usually that a person has no control over. Hence why bigotry is around sex, race, so on. Nobody chooses these things. So we're just born into this. And now, you know, it's an easy way of being able to go, there we are. This is how I can easily identify. And now there's a problem.
It's a shortcut.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting. All right. Well, yep. I think we probably have time for one more question. Helen, do you have
one? I thought this one was a good one. How does our fear change over time? How are we able to get over some fears, but not others?
Good question.
Nice of you.
Yeah. No, it's a really good question. And it's good not only because it's just good to contemplate, but it's good because effectively that's what some of this is about, really. This whole thing we've been talking about is going, well, you know, one, we can't get rid of fear any more than we can get rid of our capacity for anger, resentment, anything else that's, you know, relabeled as negative. So the question really then is, well, how do we minimize the effects? How do we redirect it? And one of the primary way we, you know, deal with, one, there's a comment around we're trying to become brave enough to face the fear. And we do that by allowing the fear to exist, accepting it, not wallowing in it, but accepting it as a road sign, a kind of internal psychological road sign pointing us in the direction of what matters. Because the more we bring our attention to that and live our lives based on supporting those things, the relationship that we have with a fear becomes less of one that says, I fear, therefore I must automatically do this. And it becomes one of, I fear, I pause and go, I have all of these ways to support the things that I'm concerned about. And that's fundamentally what we want to get to, is that flexibility of, you know, responding to what is inevitable. Because fear of loss is not going away. Nor should it. In fact, this goes to that whole thing of like, I want to get rid of my fear. No. if we got rid of it, that would mean that we ceased caring, that we ceased being able to, you know, that loss became, is no longer an issue. Well, so long as we live in a, nature, There's really, we always are, you know, possibility of loss. It's inevitable. We're literally like, I just lost a bunch of cells. I mean, it's just like, it's really like, it's just the things that's happening all the time. We are losing even our own bodies one cell at a time, all, you know, throughout the entirety of our lives. Loss is basic to life. How do we relate to it?
You just gotta tell yourself the speech from Dune over and over again. Do the fear speech in your brain.
Fear
is a mind killer. Yeah. Yep. It has helped me though on occasion, like when I'm afraid to do something new, especially when I want to take a risk, because I'm always I'm a ball of anxiety. That's just the way I live. And I told myself that speech to get myself like the fear is what's keeping you from taking an action, and you won't know what will happen until you take the action, you know? And that's even like, you know, when you're worried about like losing a loved one and you're afraid of it, what do? You reach out to your mom and say, I love you. Hi, and you check up, you know, so you can have that connection that lessens the fear a little bit, you know, so you can just, because my mom went through, you know, a lot of health crisis this past year. I went to go visit her in September. I got to hear her nurse talk to her, say that if I didn't know you had congestive heart failure, I wouldn't know. Took away a lot of my anxiety and a lot of my fear, because I was like, oh, I can breathe a little easier now. And that was because I had knowledge and the ability to connect. So,
that's the thing. And you just did that.
You
literally just went through the practice of drawing attention to what matters. You know, our emotions are great. They're fantastic as a way of directing our attention. That's what they're there for. But we don't have to respond in any kind of automatic way. I mean, sometimes it's very helpful to do so. I mean, that's why it's there. That's why the system's there. But it doesn't mean we have to all the time. We can learn, we can train ourselves to even a 5% greater degree of freedom in this relationship has an infinite possibility. Like, you're really, it's just so amazing to be able to sit back and go, all right, you know. And we can look at it in the more positive way too. Like, we feel a sense of love for somebody. What do we want to do? Do we want to do one thing over and over and over again? Or do we want to go, wow, thank you for pointing me to this person or this thing that I appreciate. Let me explore the 100 million ways of expressing this. That's what we want.
So we're giving ourselves options.
Mm-hmm.
I love that. David, as always, you have given us so much to think about. Thank you so much for all of this advice. And as someone put in the chat, free therapy. Now, disclaimer, this is not real medical advice.
This is not officially therapy. Yes.
Really good information. Thank you so much for sharing that with us. And we're definitely going to have to bring you back for number 10 appearance soon.
Got to talk about violence.
Yes.
I mean, really. Well, now
you can do that around. You can do that around Thanksgiving.
get in the mood for the holidays.
Yeah. Woo. Genocide. Yay.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. You're gonna.
I am a ball of positive energy. Let me tell you.
I love it. That's because you're a cat. So
I am.
Recovering from Religion is a nonprofit organization whose mission it is to provide hope, healing, and support to those struggling with issues of doubt and non-belief. Hope, healing, and support is waiting for you on our website, recoveringfromreligion.org. There you can speak or chat with a trained agent who will work with you through your struggles and doubts, or to help find resources that may work for you. You can also find local Recovering from Religion support groups in your area for the long-term recovery work. Resources specifically curated for those struggling with doubts, disbelief, and trauma can also be found on the RFR website. To connect with a secular therapist in your area, go to seculartherapy.org and create an account. If you'd like to support the work that RFR does, you can donate or sign up as a volunteer on the Recovering from Religion website. It's also a big help subscribing to the RFR YouTube channel, our blog, or following us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Questions, comments, and suggestions can be emailed to us at rfrx@recoveringfromreligion.org. Thanks for tuning in, and we hope you'll be with us next time on the Recovering from Religion podcast.